catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Well, that's not quite the way it is in real life, and that's what we'll be discussing today. Falling stars, or a better name for them, is meteors. And sometimes the meteors end, as this one did, in a meteorite. And sometimes the meteorites cause great holes or craters in the surface of the earth. And as my guests today, I have two senior research scientists from the astrophysics branch of National Research Council, Ottawa, both of whom have been working for years in this field and have made significant contributions. Dr. Bruce McIntosh and Dr. Ian Halliday. And I think we should start with telling people what we mean when we talk about a meteor. Bruce?
Well, a meteor is the word for the bright streak of light that we see in the sky that people normally call a falling star. It's not really a falling star, of course. It's caused by a small solid particle entering the Earth's atmosphere and essentially burning up and causing a bright streak of light. Now, these particles are almost all consumed in the atmosphere and never get down to Earth.
How many hit the atmosphere every day? It's quite a large number, isn't it?
Well, over the whole Earth, if you count all the meteors bright or brighter than an average star, it's about 1 million.
Each day?
Each day, yes. Now, the smaller they are, the more there are of them. So if you count the small ones, it becomes 500 million. More than that, even striking the Earth each day.
Earth's atmosphere. It's lucky we have the atmosphere, we don't get peppered with them all the time.
And it's fortunate that there are few big ones and more small ones.
And at times you get showers of them.
That's correct.
Coming in really big numbers.
That's correct. At certain times of the year, when the Earth gets to a certain place in its orbit around the sun, it encounters a stream of these particles. And the meteorites, the rates of falling stars, increase then very dramatically.
And to what per hour, for example?
Oh, on the average night, without any showers, an observer might be able to see, just with his naked eye, 10 per hour.
This would be a single observer.
A single observer.
Mm-hmm.
On a shower night, the rates might go up to 100 per hour. We have had some fantastic displays of meteors, one in 1966, in which the rates for a short period of time, only five minutes, but the rates were estimated at over 100,000 per hour.
Wee. I believe that was the famous Leonids, was it?
That's correct, in 1966.
Was it in Arizona that they were
there?
Peak.
Uh-huh. Unfortunately, we didn't see it here because it was cloudy.
Oh. Well, now you in Ottawa have some wonderful radar equipment for tracking these things both day and night.
That's right. This is a view of our Spring Hill Meteor Observatory. It's about 25 miles south of Ottawa. You see a main building in the center there on the roof of which we can mount cameras to photograph meteors. Above and a little to the right is an observing platform from which we can make visual observations. Towards the left-hand corners, you can see some what appear to be wire mesh. These are our radar antennas. So we observe meteors with three methods: by radar, with photographs, and simply looking for them, watching for them. The next picture here shows our visual observing compound. It consists of eight boxes, which very quickly became known as coffins. You see the people reclining in them watching for meteors, and if you look carefully, you'll see snow on the roof, so we are out in all weather, and in fact it's quite comfortable there at 10 below zero.
Except for the wind. The picture doesn't really show the wind on a good night in January.
That's quite so.
They look very comfortable. Do you have any trouble with people falling asleep?
Yes, even in 10 below weather, people tend to fall asleep. It's very difficult
all
to
night
stay
long.
Awake all night
yes.
long. Yes.
Uh-huh. And you've recorded, is it millions of radar echoes with that Spring Hill equipment?
Well, we had a radar equipment running continuously for 10 years, and I think we recorded something like 120 million meteors in that period.
How do you count them all?
Using computerized methods. Computerized data processing.
IBM cards and things like that.
Quite so.
And these would be very significant in showing the peaks of the meteor showers. And
yes, that's quite true. In this graph, the top curve, the series of dots you see there, is a plot through the year of the meteor rates as observed by our radar. You see that they're very low in January, February, March, and they rise during the summer and during the fall months. And you can see that these rates are something of the order of 200 per hour. The curve plotted in the top line is essentially for small particles. The next one down is mostly for larger particles, and one of the most prominent features is the very sharp peaks caused by the meteor showers. You see particularly one marked P there in the middle of August and one marked G in the middle of December. The rates during these showers are much higher.
P is Perseid.
For Perseid, G is for Geminid.
Geminid.
Mm-hmm. What I would like to comment on here is that these showers show up very dramatically among large particles, but do not show up among small particles. If you look at the top curve for small particles, you
can't. What do you mean by a large and a small, Bruce? What's your dividing line between them?
Well, let's say 1 gram as a dividing line. Now, 1 gram, if this particle is made of solid stone, is about the size of a pea. One of the problems is we're not really sure what they're made of. They may be solid stone, they may be a light, fluffy material, in which case 1 gram might be as large as a golf ball. It depends on how closely packed these small objects are.
And this size of a pea would be like something like a zero magnitude star?
Yes,
the
about
bright star
bright,
Vega or something?
It's about as bright as the brightest stars in the sky.
Well, there's a terrific tonnage of material coming in every day from these things, isn't it? What does it amount to?
That's quite true. It amounts to thousands of tons per day, but most of it is in fine particles. As you go down to smaller and smaller particles, there are more of them, many more of them, and most of the weight, most of the total amount that comes into the atmosphere is in these very tiny dust particles.
Which are too small to see at all, of course, aren't they?
That's correct. The only way we can detect those is by satellite observations or sending up sounding rockets into the atmosphere.
Let's go to the big particles that manage to get down. How often do fireballs come in, things as bright as the full moon?
Well, as bright as the full moon, they're getting rather rare. The term fireball, I suppose, starts for something noticeably brighter than Venus at its brightest. For every one of the large particles that the radar people speak of, perhaps there's one in 500 or one in 1,000 that would be brighter than Venus. If you want to go to things as bright as the full moon, you're probably talking about one in 10,000 of those again. So they're pretty rare, but still the Earth is has a large surface, so if you count all over the Earth, there will be several hundred per day that would be starting to approach the brightness of the moon.
And how many have been observed to come down in Canada? Now, you distinguish here between falls that people see come down and pick
yes,
up and
yes.
find
if it's found on the ground
yes.
later. Now we're talking about meteorites such as this, which was a fall near the city of Edmonton in 1960. And this was part of the Bruderheim fall, named after the nearest town to the event. And this was observed late one night just after the TV news had finished. Everybody knew exactly what time it was because TV was just going off the air. And about 600 pounds of this material was sprinkled over 3 or 4 square miles northeast of Edmonton. And this was really an important event in the study of Canadian meteorites. We'd had a fair number of meteorites before, but this one was the most material. It was recovered very quickly, which is important to get it before it's been lying in the snow. It was winter in Alberta. And to get it studied while it's still fairly fresh. Our total just went up very recently. I just heard a day or so ago of the recovery of another meteorite in Saskatchewan, which brings our Canadian total to 38. Not very many. There are about 2,000 for the whole world. Canada occupies a good portion of the land mass of the world, so our contribution of 38 is improving, but it could be better.
This would be 38 different places,
yes. The Bruderheim fall dropped several hundred actual stones. This is a small one. This would be about a pound, and there were over 600 pounds altogether.
Well, one of the reasons, of course, why we don't find so many, even though we have a large area, is that we have very low population density.
Right.
It takes people to find these things, and people we haven't got. If I can just refer to our picture here of a bright fireball, this one probably didn't drop a meteorite, but it shows you what a fireball can look like in the sky. This particular one was taken on a camera which photographs the entire sky, right from horizon to horizon in all directions. Now, that extended over a path of some 400 miles and probably was 40 miles high in the atmosphere. These fireballs seldom get down below 10 or 12 miles, so that when people see them and think that they're really just over the next hill, it's probably not true. They're probably 200 miles away and perhaps 20 miles high. They're very, very bright and can be seen over long distances. And
there's no sense of perspective left.
Very deceiving.
No, they're just a streak in the sky. And
what velocities do they have on an average?
Well, if we're talking about the ones which might drop an actual meteorite, the stone, they tend to be on the slow side for meteors because of the type of orbit they seem to inhabit. It's still very fast by ordinary...
They're slow. They're only 30,000 miles per hour. So
right. Your Leonid meteors you were studying with radar can be 5 or 6 times faster than the average meteorite.
140,000 miles per hour.
So there's quite a big range for meteors, for the stones, the meteorites. They're on the slow side of this very high velocity group.
Is it true that Western Canada is getting the edge a little bit on Eastern Canada for finding meteorites?
Not only Western Canada, but Alberta has had the lion's share in the past 30 years. I think they have had 8 of the 18 meteorites recovered in Canada. And what is it, 6 of those in the past 10 years?
The past 10 years, the 1960s were pretty good for Canadian meteorites. There were a total of 12 recovered in Canada. The one we just heard of is the first for the 1970s. We had none last year, and this is the first one this year. We've been setting up a program in the Canadian prairies to try to recover more of these meteorites.
Yes, you've got how many stations going there?
12 small photographic stations where we run 5 cameras at each station watching the sky.
60 cameras.
60 cameras, yes. And the idea is to photograph the position of the streaks in the sky so that we can calculate where to go and look for them. And the other part of it is that we have to know the speed with which they're coming in to understand where the particle used to go in the solar system. The people who study the meteorites, they want to know, how close did this come to the sun? What kind of radiation was it exposed to last month when it was closer to the sun?
Mm-hmm.
You need photographs to tell you that. The visual observer has no chance of giving you an accurate enough observation to decipher that kind of information.
The thing is too quick.
You can't estimate the speed of it to an accuracy of 1 or 2%, and we need this.
Mm-hmm. And what about Ontario? What are the most recent ones here?
Oh, during the 1960s, there were 2 small meteorites found in Ontario, none that were observed to fall. Now, there are different 2 main kinds of meteorites, stone meteorites, in which most of the material is stony material, although there is a fair bit of metallic iron in it. It's quite common even in the stones. They're the common group. For every 100 meteorites that land, perhaps 90 are the stone kind. The other type are the irons, A little more spectacular. They're natural stainless steel, if you like. These are slices, of course. They've been cut with a saw. They don't come in looking flat like this. And the two that were found in Ontario during the 1960s were both irons of this general type.
We might say that one of the obvious characteristics of meteorites, particularly the stony type, is the black crust they have on the outside. This is particularly noticeable.
It's typical, yes.
In this sample from the Bruderheim, you can see perhaps one of the corners where the black crust has been chipped off.
And it looks spots. It's just a dull gray.
It looks very much like gray concrete inside. Perhaps the texture of concrete is about the best way to describe it. But this black fusion crust is because it's been subjected to tremendous heating passing mm-hmm. through the atmosphere, and the outer layers have in fact actually melted and fused again in this black.
It's an iron oxide, really, yes. From the iron in the meteorite.
It's mm-hmm. not really just a smoke blacket. It's a crust with a finite thickness. We get many rocks that people think are meteorites that have just perhaps been in a bonfire somewhere and got smoke blackened.
Oh, yes.
And they're not real meteorites.
These were really cooked on the outside as uh-huh. they rushed through the atmosphere. Uh-huh.
Well, they have lost a large fraction of their weight before they get to Earth. Uh-huh.
And there are various other chemical tests that distinguish meteorites from
meteorites. Yes, there are some kinds that might be difficult to distinguish from certain rocks, but in general they can be rather easily distinguished by people familiar with meteorites.
We have to go back quite a few years, don't we, for one that was seen to fall in Ontario? Was the
Destin? Yes, 1939. That's quite a long time ago.
Well, it should be time for
Ontario has really only had 10 of the 38 meteorites that have fallen in Canada. I think we're overdue for another one.
We should find some more. Mm-hmm.
Of a football, of these boulders, get slowed down in the atmosphere, and they essentially drop. Well, small.
The smaller particles are very well, small of this size, the size of a football, a big boulder. Get slowed down in the atmosphere, and they essentially drop at very slow speeds. Now, if they get larger and larger, the atmosphere no longer slows them down, and they will strike the Earth at this tremendous speed at which they enter the atmosphere.
With cosmic velocity, as the Russians like to say. I like that.
In other words, they will strike the Earth at 25,000 miles per hour. And because of this tremendous speed, this is really a tremendous explosion that can be created by these objects.
And we have the scars on the Canadian soil.
Yes, Canada has a great deal of very old rock, and this rock remembers what happened to it a long time ago. So we're in a fortunate position to be able to look over the rock of Canada and go back in history. Not just thousands of years, not just millions of years, but perhaps as much in some cases as 1 or 2 billion years, almost half the age of the whole entire Earth.
Well, hasn't Canada really been in the forefront of the countries of the world in the search for old meteorite craters?
Yes, I think this is a fair statement. The meteor crater in Arizona was the only one known for a long time. This is some 4,000 feet across.
That's what this rock
that's where that one came from. That's mm-hmm. part of the object that hit there. But since the discovery in 1950 of the crater in far northern Quebec, which has had a variety of names, but has been called Chubb Crater after the prospector who first went in there with Dr. Mean of the Royal Ontario Museum. And Dr. Mean was the one really to establish that this was, in fact, a rather old meteorite crater. Old by our normal standards, we're thinking here of perhaps 100,000 years. This is
really a young crater by
astronomically and geologically, yes. As the program went on in Canada and an intensive search was made of essentially all of Canada, we found no others as young as that.
This search was made through aerial photographs initially.
You had a million or so of them, didn't you?
I think over 2 million were searched altogether.
My.
Mainly by summer students.
Dr. C.S. Beals and a few people at the Dominion Observatory were...
Many people were involved in this. I had only a very small part, but Dr. Beals headed it up for many years, and I think the credit for the success must go to him.
Surprisingly enough, this search of aerial photographs only turned up one.
Which one
crater.
Was that?
This is the Holliford crater, which is near Kingston in Ontario, and it is the smallest in Canada. It's only 1.25 miles in diameter. The sort of size of craters that we have in Canada range from this size, roughly 1 mile, to about 50 miles.
Among the ones that we would consider definitely established,
yes.
Now, Ontario does pretty well with the meteorite craters, doesn't it?
Yes. At present, I think we could say there are 4 that we would consider established. The Brent crater in Algonquin Park was the second one discovered after the one up in far northern Quebec. It was discovered by some aerial photographers who brought it to Dr. Beale's attention. And it was really in 1951, it was really the discovery of 2 of them, just a year apart, that spurred on the search for more. So we have the Brent crater, which is 2 to 3 miles across, the Holliford crater near Kingston, and then a very interesting one for which there has been a lot of controversy, the Sudbury Basin, the greatest nickel mine in the world.
Mm.
And people who study meteorite craters today accept the fact that this was in some way due to the impact of a huge meteorite a very long time ago, more than 1 billion years.
What leads to that conclusion?
Well, the study of the rock, as I said, the rock remembers that something hit it, and when a big meteorite hits, the pressure it produces for a brief instant can be millions of pounds per square inch. And the rock says, ouch, and it changes its nature forever. And it seems that there is no other process of which we know operating near the surface of the earth that can do this. Volcanoes generate pressures, but not millions of pounds per square inch. So the crystals in the rock can be split into microscopic fractures. The rock itself can be melted if the pressure is great enough. There can be several varieties of damage that survive, it seems, almost forever.
One of the problems, of course, in crater studies is that although the rock does remember what happened to it, the rock may get covered up and you can't find it.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
To get this out because of glacial action, it scrapes the land, fills in the craters, there may be foliage grow over them, and it's sometimes difficult to find these. This is, as opposed to the situation on the moon, where there is no such action, at least not on this scale. There are other actions going on the moon and on Mars, and the craters, once they're formed, are essentially there forever.
Well, you've done extensive drilling on these old craters, and you've got one of the drill cores.
Yes, in many cases, the original crater bowl is filled with water and forms a lake. And if you're going to study the rock that lies under the lake, how are you going to get at it? In a couple of cases, they've been lucky enough to have glaciers do the work for us and dredge out some of the material from the bottom and pile it on one shore. But in many other cases, you simply have a lake, and if you're going to get the material from the bottom, you have to drill for it. And about 7 of the 18 craters that are now recognized in Canada have been drilled in this way. Not always through water, but sometimes through as much as 400 feet of water, which was a challenge for the Canadian drilling industry that they met very well. There were some interesting accidents, but in general, they had very good success. So a piece such as this shows up a large number of fragments. This was from nearly 1,800 feet below the present lake.
Which crater?
West Hawk Lake, just inside the Manitoba border. It missed being in Ontario by about 1 mile.
Oh.
So this is a lake. It's been glaciated, eroded back. The present lake is much bigger than the original crater.
How big in diameter, approximately?
The lake is 2.5 miles in diameter and places up to 3 miles. We think the original crater was not much more than 1.5 miles across the rim.
This photograph doesn't really show the extent of the lake, but you can see the rim on the far side there.
Yes, this is well worn back now by glacial action, and of course it makes a beautiful summer resort for the city of Winnipeg. It's east of Winnipeg and just nicely into the lake country.
And what would be the approximate age of that hit?
It's one of a large group of the Canadian ones that would be estimated between 100 and 200 million years old. It's a long time.
Some of these craters weren't seen on the aerial photographs because, in general, the aerial photographs don't cover very much area. And some of the craters, such as the one in Quebec, the Manicouagan structure, which is 50 miles across, you can see on an ordinary road map, essentially, if the lakes are well drawn on a road map, you just have to look at it, and there it is.
These are the lakes that are producing the Manicouagan Dam, of course, the great power generating
development.
Oh, is that so? Well. And you mentioned a fourth one recently in Ontario.
In Ontario, yes. This is Lake Wanapitei. And by coincidence, it happens to overlap the Sudbury Basin, although it has nothing particularly to do with it. It's very much younger than the basin. But it's another lake which was partially at least produced by the impact of a large meteorite. There may be more. There's another one being studied this winter. If the ice conditions are good enough, it's a bad winter for ice. Too much snow. This one west of Huntsville, a smaller lake, and there's a good chance, but it's much too soon to say definitely that that's a fifth Ontario crater. It may well be.
Well, now, the meteorite wouldn't have brought the ore into the Sudbury Basin, presumably, or would the ore have welled up from the earth?
Most people, I think, would go along with it being welled up from the earth. The interesting point here is that the geologist who first suggested it as a meteorite crater now thinks that perhaps it is the ore itself, the nickel itself, may be from the meteorites.
Oh, is that Dr. Dietz?
Dr. Bob Dietz, yes, who is a marine geologist, but an extremely versatile person. He has an interesting habit of turning out 10 years later to be right.
Well, and he now thinks the ore may have come.
Yes, he was talking about this just a few months ago at a meeting on meteors and meteorites.
Oh.
He was the one who essentially discovered the Sudbury structure, or at least first thought that the Sudbury structure might be due to a giant meteorite, and simply because of the shock-deformed structure of the rocks in that area.
Oh, are the shatter cones around it?
Yes, they produce a conical structure in the rock called shatter cones, and these vary in size from very tiny ones to up to 10 feet. There are some in the Charlevoix structure, which is near Quebec City on the St. Lawrence. And they have, of course, you can't dig these out of the rock, but they have photographs of some shatter cones there up to 10 feet in size.
Mm. And was it Dietz that called the Sudbury hit an astrobleem?
That's a word of his, yes. It means a wound, a star wound, if you like.